This is the CSIS Global Health Interview Series at www.smartglobalhealth.org.
Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Bliss, and I'm a senior fellow with the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We are here today with Dr. Ronald Waldman, a Global Health Fellow at the United States Agency for International Development. Dr. Waldman has just returned from Haiti, where he served as the coordinator of the United States Medical and Health Emergency Response to the January 12th earthquake. He's here today to talk with us about the current health situation in Haiti and to discuss the short-term and long-term health challenges Haiti faces as it works to rebuild in the months to come. Dr. Waldman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I know you've been working on the ground in Haiti over the past 6 weeks, arriving shortly after the earthquake. Can I ask you to describe the immediate health needs and challenges when you arrived and to say a bit about how the situation has evolved since then?
I'll try. When I first arrived in Haiti, the situation was quite chaotic, as you could imagine. The direct impact of the earthquake was astounding, and it was very difficult, frankly, to sort things out. Obviously, at the beginning, the immediate concern was to identify survivors and to attend to their injuries, which at times were quite frightful. Many people, over 200,000, according to the estimate of the Haitian government, were killed, and a similar number were injured. It was very difficult to assure those people who did survive access to the medical care and attention that they needed. Organizations were busily putting up clinics and surgical units to attend to the injured, but it was quite disorganized. And the immediate challenge, of course, was to try to match injured people on the basis of an extent of their injury to providers who could give them the level of care that they required. The physical injuries ranged from quite minor lacerations that maybe required a few stitches to massive crush injuries that might require amputation of limbs or that might result in a patient being paralyzed if they did not receive immediate attention. Many groups were arriving to provide this kind of assistance. Some groups quite professional in the rapid establishment of field hospitals. The U.S. Navy provided the United States naval ship Comfort, a top-of-the-line hospital ship, which can carry out even the most complex of surgical procedures. But it was difficult, to say the least, to make sure that all of those people who were in need of attention received that attention. Not to mention the fact that the population in general was stunned. Many, many people had lost relatives, friends, possessions. People were homeless, rendered homeless by the earthquake as their houses fell down, didn't know where to go, and it was quite a chaotic and very difficult situation to address.
Can you say a bit about how the situation has evolved since then? What are the current challenges that are facing the government at this point?
Well, so over time, things became increasingly more organized. I wish I could say that it had gone better than, in fact, it has. I'm not trying to say that it didn't gone as well as it might have, but clearly the task at hand was overwhelming and exceeded the capacity of anything that existed in Haiti prior to the arrival of the international humanitarian community. And in fact, I think it would be fair to say that it exceeded the capacity of the international humanitarian community to do everything that was needed to do. Nevertheless, with time, the situation became more organized. More and more patients did receive at least primary treatment for their injuries. Many lives were saved because of medical and surgical interventions. And patients slowly began to be matched with appropriate care facilities. Still, not nearly to the degree that one would have wished, but each day to a greater and greater degree, at least. The situation has evolved, and at this point in time, everyone who survived the earthquake and who had an earthquake-related injury has been seen by the medical community at least once. This doesn't mean that dealing with those direct consequences of the earthquake is a task that's finished. Many of the patients who were injured and who required surgical procedures will have wounds that will become infected because of the conditions under which those surgeries were performed. Many of them will require secondary and tertiary procedures for the revision of their wounds, for the treatment of ulcerations of the skin that sometimes are quite deep that might have been caused by the fact that they lay underneath the rubble for hours or days before being rescued. Many people will have to have still these kinds of repair procedures. Some people who have had amputations may have to have more work done on those. And as time goes by, there will be an attempt to treat all of the amputees appropriately in most instances, I would hope, by trying to fit prosthetic devices. That means that there will have to be surgical revisions of their stump in order to enable a prosthetic device to fit properly. So all of these things that are the result, the direct result of the earthquake, will continue to be needed. However, we're right now increasingly concerned about what might be called the indirect consequences of the earthquake. We're sort of in an in-between phase now between having dealt with the injured but not having provided adequately as yet for all those hundreds of thousands of people, literally, who are homeless because of the destruction of their homes and who are living outdoors in smaller or larger camps for internally displaced people. They live in makeshift housing, in very congested conditions, with inadequate shelter and inadequate sanitation on top of that. I will say that attention has been paid to date to ensuring that everyone has adequate food and water, and enormous progress has been made in those areas. Shelter and sanitation remain somewhat more difficult to address because of the conditions, and we are concerned that the conditions may have the potential to lead to outbreaks of communicable diseases that could be the cause of a second disaster, this time one caused by the indirect rather than the direct consequences of the earthquake.
Looking toward the next few months, what does the arrival of the rainy season mean for the health situation in Haiti? You've said that so many people are living in temporary camps or housing, and that making sure people have shelter and sanitation is already a challenge. What are the health risks that will be confronted over the next few months, and how are the Haitian authorities, along with their international partners, preparing to address them?
Well, the arrival of the rainy season means trouble. It means that there will, every year with the onset of the rains, there's an increase in the occurrence of certain communicable diseases, in particular watery diarrheas, dysentery, and vector-borne illnesses such as malaria and dengue. Obviously, this year, things can be even worse because of the conditions that prevail, not only in Port-au-Prince, but even outside in the areas of the country that were not affected directly by the earthquake because of the flight of people to these areas and the stress that that displacement puts on the very weak Haitian infrastructure, particularly in health. So I've mentioned some of the conditions that we're concerned about. As you can see, they're all things that are caused by either deficiencies in sanitation or by exposure to the elements, which is a function of there being not enough shelter. There are many plans being made to deal with these conditions. Obviously, progress, again, is being made on a daily basis in terms of being able to provide at least temporary shelter in the form of plastic sheeting that people can use to create a roof over their heads. It's not an ideal solution by any means, but it's certainly one that can be implemented more quickly than physical reconstruction of destroyed dwellings. So the idea is to get at least one piece of this waterproof tarpaulin material to everyone as quickly as possible, and then a second sheet as well before the rains begin. What this allows is for people to be able to take a semi-sturdy structure and to cover it in a way that provides them with more protection from the elements. It could be some sticks that they throw together to form a dome-like structure if they're completely without anything else. It could be used to just cover holes in a partially destroyed dwelling unit. The tarp sheeting has a lot of uses, and it's proven to be a reasonable but very temporary solution in other disasters that are similar to this one. In terms of sanitation, it's also a difficult area to address, and one that is perhaps lagging a bit, but where, again, progress is being made every day. Latrines are being done, trench latrines at first, and a number of portable toilets are being brought in, a large number. I suspect that by the time the rains come, the international standard for what's required in disaster response may not actually be met, but the situation, the potential for catastrophe is offset a little bit by the fact that many of the people who are displaced are still in relative proximity to their neighborhoods, and they do go back and forth between what's left of their homes and the camps in which they're staying. So at least when I left a couple of days ago, it was a little bit surprising that the condition of the camps in terms of sanitation wasn't a lot worse than what it actually was.
There's been quite a bit of news related to the high level of international assistance and response to Haiti since the earthquake. And I wanted to ask you to say a few words about the nature of international cooperation on the ground. What countries and international organizations are working in partnership with Haitian authorities to address health issues? Are there benefits as well as challenges related to the presence of so many governments, international agencies, and NGOs working on health?
Well, so a few years ago, the United Nations undertook a series of what are called humanitarian reforms. And these reforms are basically three in nature. One is that there would be designated a humanitarian coordinator for each emergency to oversee and ensure a higher degree of international coordination than was previously the case. The second was to develop a system of clusters, as they're called, to address each sector. So there would be a health cluster, a sanitation cluster, a shelter cluster, a logistics cluster, and so on and so forth. And these clusters are chaired by a United Nations agency and the representative of the non-governmental organizations on the ground, working under the leadership of the host country government. The system has helped to ensure a higher degree of cooperation, and a lot of it depends on the strength, the experience, and the expertise of the people who are put in leadership roles. Some clusters always perform somewhat better than others, but I would say that on the whole, the level of cooperation is reasonably good. Cooperation, coordination, I call these things the slowest common denominator. Sometimes it's easier to think that a single organization moving ahead at full speed can get a lot more done than a group of organizations that need to take time to talk to each other, check with each other, run plans by each other, suffer from the criticisms of others, and so on and so forth. But really, without the cooperation and coordination, especially together with the host country government, very little can be done. So it may be a little bit slower, but in the end, it turns out to be more effective. The leading donors in Haiti are the United States, which has been by far the biggest and most visible, Canada, the European Union, and France. So there is a high degree of coordination among those partners as well. My specific job was to try to coordinate the efforts of different U.S. government agencies, and mostly the United States for International Development, which was assigned the lead in the health area, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Health and Human Services. And I think we did achieve quite a high level and an unusually high level of cooperation and coordination in making sure that the U.S. government was speaking with a single and unified voice, moving forward in the same direction and moving in the same direction together with the international community. We assigned many of our personnel to the various clusters to provide technical assistance and to be able to ensure that the U.S. would be part of a multilateral effort, a big part to be sure. But the worst thing that can happen in situations like this is for different players to be moving in different directions. They tend to nullify each other's efforts, and they make it much more difficult to pull things together at the other end of the emergency when the reconstruction effort needs to begin.
Well, I know the earthquake happened relatively recently, and you have emphasized that, of course, the health situation continues to evolve. But I know you have considerable experience working on health in disaster relief situations around the world. And I wonder if you could say a few words about what situations with which you've been involved in the past have provided lessons for the relief effort in Haiti. And at the same time, are there lessons that can be drawn from Haiti's recent experience that may be relevant for future efforts?
Well, I think that this is undoubtedly the largest disaster that anyone in the relief community has seen. I think that even the number of deaths and injured is extraordinary, but it really only tells part of the story. I think to try to come to grips with the fact that a large urban area that was the capital of a country, the seat of government, just collapsed. It's really difficult to fathom. And then as one drills down a little bit further and realizes that everyone in that city, even the survivors, have suffered tremendous losses, either in terms of family, relatives, possessions. Everyone is really stunned and will be for some time. The psychological impact of the earthquake is as devastating as the physical one in many ways. I would just want to point out also that the same is true for expatriates. You know, for us who arrived at the U.S. Embassy, there was a U.S. Embassy there. There was a USAID mission there. Other U.S. government personnel had been there. All of them also suffered the same losses. In turn, the earthquake didn't discriminate and impact only Haitians. So we were called immediately to work with our colleagues on the ground, and we expected them to pitch in and make a team with us. It's hard to bear in mind that they had just been through an incredibly traumatic experience. The same for our Haitian colleagues, obviously, in the Ministry of Health, in my case, or in any government position, the ministries were destroyed. So there was no place for them to go to work. We like to say that things should get back to normal as quickly as possible. That's part of the alleviation of the stress, the psychological stress that's put on people. What does getting back to normal mean? It means having children go back to school as quickly as possible, but there are no schools. It means having people be able to have spiritual outlets in which they can grieve, but there are no churches. They've been destroyed by the earthquake. Clinics, not there. Banks, not there. So this is really the kind of tragedy that will take years and years to overcome. We've learned that from the past. We've learned from the past that as quickly as you want to move in the beginning, you need to start right away, right from the beginning, taking a longer-term view of things. And everything you do in the first few days or weeks should be the basis of what's going to happen down the line. So you have to have a fairly clear picture of where you want to end up. You have to start working with government authorities right away so that they can tell you where they hope this will lead in the next 6 months of a year so that you can work in a way that is building towards the future. That was a little bit difficult to do in this setting, but I think it was done adequately, and it really gave the right direction, I think, to the relief efforts, at least in the health sector. We've learned that experience is important, and I know that many people want to rush in and offer whatever it is they think they can offer in situations like this, but some organizations that come to help are more professional than others. They do this for a living. They exist not only, they're not only formed at the time of a tragedy, but they exist always, and they provide training to their personnel, and they are prepared in terms of the resources that they have available, the commodities and the skills that they can bring to the relief area. So one needs to sort out a little bit between the more professional agencies and the more amateur ones, if I can put it that way, as generous of spirit and of money as they might be. So having so many players on the ground does, in fact, complicate things in a way. Yet that's what the cluster is formed for. It's to be able to help the government do that kind of discrimination. So this has been learned in the past, and I'd say in the last few large disasters, the tsunami, for example, the earthquake in Iran that occurred a few years ago, the earthquake in Pakistan, I think that there's some evidence that the system is working much better than it had previously. If one goes back to the humanitarian disaster that occurred in the wake of the Rwanda genocide, and that played out in what was then Zaire, is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. I think we've really learned a lot since then. That occurred in 1994, and from that episode came a movement to establish a set of international standards. They're codified in something called the SPHERE Project, S-P-H-E-R-E. There's a handbook for minimum standards in disaster response on their website, which is called www.sphereproject.org. And people are making every effort to adhere to those standards that were pulled together by a very large coalition of non-governmental organizations and United Nations agencies. We have learned from the past, and I think that this disaster relief effort in Haiti should provide many, many lessons for the future as well. I think that because of the nature of the response, because we've reached a certain point where we know what ought to be done, we can compare what actually is being done to what we know should be done and see how well people have performed. I'm hoping that different agencies will draw as many lessons as they can from this, and that the next time we're called on to provide an international effort for disaster relief, an effort that I hope will be able to be much, much smaller than this one, I hope we'll be able to perform even better. I think that the level of cooperation, as I said earlier, on the ground for the Haiti disaster earthquake relief was quite high, quite good. I think the circumstances were somewhat overwhelming, but I think that in the end, I'm hoping that we will look back and have a feeling that as much was accomplished as was humanly possible.
Dr. Waldman, thank you very much. I just want to end by asking you if there are any additional points that you'd like to share with our listeners.
I guess I just want to summarize a little bit by saying that, you know, these disasters usually go, there's an emergency relief phase, and when that is dealt with adequately, there's a second phase of trying to prevent what I called before the second disaster, and then there's a long recovery phase when things stabilize. I think what's particular and peculiar to this, to the Haiti earthquake, is that all three of these things have to be done at the same time. So I just want to repeat maybe that even the traumatic injuries psychological and especially physical that were incurred at the time of the earthquake on the 12th of January will need to be dealt with for months and months to come, and actually years when one thinks of prosthetic devices needing to be put on children who will continue to grow. It's estimated that there are 4,000 amputees in Haiti now because of the earthquake. That's a lot of people for a weak health system and an even weaker health system when it comes to orthopedics and rehabilitation to deal with. The commitment needs to be there. The plan needs to be there to help the Haitian health system, help the Haitian people to cope with their needs that were physical injuries incurred at the time of the earthquake. The second line of work now is dealing with this tremendous number of displaced people, both in Port-au-Prince and scattered throughout the countryside. Again, it's going to be a question of months, probably years, until their homes can be rebuilt, adequate shelter provided, and camps organized in such a way that the living conditions are conducive to a healthy and productive life. That's not the case now. Now it's like putting Band-Aids on, but the more permanent cures need to come down the line. Thirdly, is the reconstruction effort. And by reconstruction, I mean not only putting the buildings back up, but also getting government processes back up and running, creating jobs for people so that they can have an economic life that enables them to take care of themselves and their families, and then trying to bring together a sense of social cohesion so that the foundations of society can be restored. Haitians are a tremendous have tremendous social force. They congregate, they take care of each other to a large extent, but right now the conditions are such that it's very difficult to cope. I do want to end just by saying at least that Haiti, prior to the earthquake, was a relatively neglected country by the international community, and it was quite undeveloped in many ways. In fact, in the health sector, all of the health parameters which we usually use to measure progress were the lowest in the Western Hemisphere. I don't think that anyone really has in mind restoring Haiti or helping to restore Haiti to what it was before. What it was before was inadequate and unfair to the population. I think we all want to build back a better Haiti, one that can provide better health care, better economic opportunities, and better governance, better in every sense than what it was before. And that's going to take an enormous and long-term commitment by the international community to provide Haiti with the financial resources that will be required, with the technical assistance that will be required, and with the support in every other way that will be required in order to enable Haiti to not continue to be at the bottom of Western Hemisphere countries in these parameters, but rather to occupy a higher place.
Dr. Waldman, thank you so much for sharing your insight and perspective on the current health situation in Haiti with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn more, please visit www.smartglobalhealth.org.